From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Like no armed conflict before, the Persian Gulf War forced us to recognize the relentless advance of technology. Against the backdrop of conventional warfare, we became instantly aware that the weapons of war had changed dramatically. Alvin and Heidi Toffler are the authors of War and Anti-War, which follows in the footsteps of their earlier works, Future Shock and The Third Wave. We'll discuss how the instruments of war, as well as the instruments of peace, are moving to selective custom weapons, and quite simply, to the possession of information itself. I'll also speak with Lieutenant General Thomas Moorman, Vice Commander of the Air Force Space Command. General Moorman tells us how the U.S. Space Command participated in the Persian Gulf War and how the Air Force is planning our strategic future in space. Alvin Toffler and his wife Heidi Toffler have looked at the evolution of society for many years, but only recently have they focused on the subjects of war and peace. In a recent interview in Wired magazine, Alvin Toffler described the cutting edge of technological warfare as being based on information superiority. Yet in their new book, War and Anti-War, the Tofflers begin with an early 20th century quote from Trotsky. "You may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you." I asked them what it meant and why they started there.
Well, that means that your life has been shaped by wars fought in the past, wars that may be fought in the future, and wars that are even embedded in our culture and imagination, in the paintings, in the museums, in the music of the past, in culture. War has been such a powerful phenomenon in social evolution that it occupies part of our cultural, it's part of our cultural DNA. That doesn't mean that we're aggressive and that we're nasty people, that we have to have wars and so forth, but the likelihood, of course, is that there is conflict and there is violent conflict and that we had better pay attention.
Throughout several books now, you've described a first, second, and third societal wave. If you would describe those waves and what they mean in terms of war.
We divide history very grossly. You can divide history into 1,000 different waves or periods, but basically we divide the historical past into three great waves of change, the first being the agricultural revolution, which occurred about 10,000 years ago and spread across Europe at the rate of 1 kilometer a year for 9,000 years. And, of course, it was the invention of planting a seed in the ground and rather than hunting and gathering. The second great wave of change was brought about by the Industrial Revolution of about 250 or 300 years ago. And, of course, that spread across the planet at a much faster rate. And now we date the third wave of change at about 1955, and it is we are leaving industrial civilization and moving into what we call the third wave. The Russians called it the scientific and technological revolution. Brzezinski called it the technotronic age. Daniel Bell called it post-industrial society. You can call it whatever you want, but it is not a continuation of industrial civilization. It's something brand new.
How has that been reflected, then, in the wars? How have the wars changed?
Well, okay, that's the thesis of War and Anti-War. By the way, this is a book which is a great departure from anything we ever wrote before, and there's a story about how we got into it, but that's beside the point at the moment. What we've discovered, when we saw the Gulf War unfold, we saw the end of the old and the beginning of the new in terms of warfare. And basically, we found that what's happening is that when a society changes its basic way of making wealth, its way of producing goods, services, necessities for people, then it also changes the way it fights.
But why don't you talk about the differences between the second wave and the third wave
in terms
of production?
Yeah, for example,
mass production.
Historically, when the Industrial Revolution was in its early stages, Napoleon came along, the French Revolution, even before Napoleon. You had the beginnings of mass production society was accompanied by mass conscription. It was accompanied by a growing emphasis in writers like Clausewitz on war, or in the actual tactics and ways war were fought. We went from mass production to mass destruction,
and
culminating with
the
nuclear
weapon.
Also
the point at which the machine gun was invented, which is a weapon of mass destruction.
In its day, you have a machine age, you have a machine gun. You have a mass production, mass consumption, mass education, mass recreation, mass media society. You have mass destruction. That was the dominant concept of war until now, basically, until very recently. What is now happening is a change in the way we make our wealth, the way our economy works. We're now an information-intensive society. There's a change in the relationship of knowledge to production, so that in the advanced factories in the world, you do not find just mass production of millions of identical widgets. You find the capability of customizing products, 100 of these, one of those, 3,000 of the other, 10 of these, and so forth, continually changing the product, because computer-driven technology, information-based manufacturing, makes variation possible and makes customization possible.
Well, but it's more than possible. It's as cheap as mass production was, or it almost as cheap. The benefit of mass production was the more alike items that you made, the cheaper each item was. It was called the economies of scale. Now, with computerized controls and automated equipment, it is almost as cheap to make 100 different items as it was to make a million of the same items.
And the consequence of that is what we call the demassification of mass production. And the parallel in war is the demassification of mass destruction. And therefore, you see taking place in the military, in military affairs, the rise of precision-targeted weaponry. In 1881, when the British fleet bombarded Alexandria, it fired 3,000 shells, of which only 10 hit Alexandria in the Gulf War. We begin, just the beginning, we begin to see the absolute precision of weaponry moving toward a warfare based on one target, one weapon, instead of thousands and thousands and thousands of bombs to hit one building in a city. That, in a nutshell, is the parallel. What you're seeing is the customization of destruction in parallel with the customization of production. And we go through, in war and anti-war, we go through 10, at least 10, there are many, many more, 10 examples of how the military is changing in exact parallel with the way the economy is changing.
Now tell us, what is anti-war, and is that different from peace?
Well, anti-war are all of those activities that prevent or limit the consequences of war.
Wow, but a man named Tolstoy used the title War and Peace. So
that was
he used it up.
Right,
he used it up.
But anti is against, so that the implication, peace is the absence of war, but anti-war is against war, so it would be everything that you do.
But that includes, that is not just a question of political pressures or demonstrations for peace and so on, although these play a role, but it also includes things like deterrence, and it also includes the actual use of military force on occasion to prevent worse force. In fact, that's the theory not working very well of our intervention in Somalia. And so on. So
but
there are many.
That the critical factor of production today in the emerging third wave is information. And certainly information is a key component of how we make war. And we say it should be a key component of how we make peace.
That's exactly right. That's the thesis. The thesis of the book is that a change in the economic production system of a society produces a change in the war-fighting capabilities and methods of that society, historically, not just for us, but in the past as well. And that, therefore, there grows up with that a parallel form of peacemaking and peacekeeping. so that in the past, when you had a certain kind of civilization, a first wave or a second wave civilization, you had first wave or second wave peacekeeping methods. What we are now on is the edge, the brink of a new civilization with new forms of violence that have to be met with new forms of peacekeeping. And that, and the essence of the new forms of violence is knowledge. It's the relationship of knowledge to war that has changed, and therefore the relationship of knowledge to peace and peacemaking and deterrence must change. And that means everything from, it means we need a knowledge strategy for peace.
Give you a small example. When Yeltsin was shooting at the people in the Russian White House and killing the members of parliament who were making a coup, we won't discuss whether we should have supported Yeltsin or not. That's we did. But if the parliamentary coup makers had succeeded in taking over the television station, perhaps we should have had a satellite up there ready to help Yeltsin if they had taken it over, to simply blanket out and put our own or Yeltsin's own television station, so that he could continue
We should have parked a satellite up there and said, Boris, here's the key.
And so what we're talking about then is knowledge intervention on the part of peace.
Right. And in
as
lieu,
we're using knowledge in war, as we saw with the smart bombs during the
and we can systematically plan a kind of strategy. Now, there are major problems. There are civil liberties, freedom of press, media questions, secrecy, all kinds of complications. But if you look, you see that a lot of peacekeeping effort depends upon satellite monitoring, verification of peace treaties, compliance, make sure that the forces are not moving where they're not supposed to be moving, and so forth and so on. That's all high-tech, knowledge-based anti-war activity. And the same thing goes for Bosnia.
In Bosnia, when ethnic hatreds started up, they did not exist under communism. I think the generation that grew up wasn't much concerned with the past, but when Yugoslavia began to break up, people who wanted power and wanted control started the old ethnic hostilities. What if at that point in time we had provided radio stations and
media
simple
access.
In the languages of the people to diffuse that ethnic hatred? You have to ask, you know, would it have gone as far as it did if that had happened then?
I'm reminded of the student revolts or demonstrations in China, where what was so different is that so many Chinese students here in the United States were faxing in news reports into China, and there was nothing anyone could do. They could not suppress the information.
Exactly, exactly. And the sterile debate in Washington is, should we send ground troops to Bosnia? No, it's a quagmire. Should we do airstrikes? Well, they might not work. Should we lift the arms embargo? The answer is lift the information embargo, because Milosevic controls the media, and there are peace forces and moderates in those societies who would stop the war if they had a chance, but they have no access to a microphone or a television camera. We should be dropping that to them. We should be giving them access to, we should be giving them PCs. We should be hooking them up. We should park a ship off the coast and let them come out in a little boat and broadcast into the place. Now, one of the things we propose in the book is the creation of a rapid reaction media force that goes into crisis situations like this. And now, as I say, that is there sovereignty? Is there such a thing as information sovereignty? Do we want other people broadcasting to us? The answer is that's inevitable, because the day is going to come when a satellite dish is as small as a saucer, the electronic component is the size of a nickel, and there's going to be receiving from all over the world, and that has other problems. In fact, it's we may be moving into an era of technological culture busting, because we're going to get probably through automatic translation in our own language, we will turn on the tube, and if we want, we'll see Nigerian television, or we'll get the latest call to arms from the latest Ayatollah in Iran.
Well, I welcome that, because I think very often we don't get the other side's point of view.
But I'm not sure I welcome the Ayatollah's propaganda.
Yeah, but a lot of times fanatics take hostages just so they can get on the media give their message. And
they don't have to take over the radio station
anymore.
There are
500 channels, 1,000 channels, a million channels. Okay, so we're moving into a very, very strange era. But clearly, at the heart of all of this is a new uses of knowledge. And to have not to recognize the relationship between war-making, economic the forms of economic development, and peace, we say that every civilization produces its own characteristic war form and produces its own characteristic peace form. And we need to recognize the need for a new peace form.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guests today are Alvin and Heidi Toffler. They're authors of the book War and Anti-War. How did you come to write this book?
As Al said, we had absolutely no interest in military subjects. But we wrote a book that was published in 1980 called The Third Wave, which develops in detail the changes that we saw happening. And about a year and a half after the book was published, we got a call from a General Morelli who invited us down to Washington and told us that he had used, or the Army had used, our book, The Third Wave, in rewriting Army doctrine. And at that point, we were so ignorant, we said, what is doctrine?
What is military doctrine?
Yeah.
Well, doctrine, it turns out there's a manual for every kind of fighting you can imagine, river fighting, snow fighting, desert fighting, urban, whatever. There's a doctrine. And every military writes its doctrine, and they exchange them by and large. They're pretty much open.
But there's nothing in The Third Wave about the military. He said, you talk about the demassification of production, the demassification of distribution, the demassification of the media. He said, did you ever think that there's a parallel demassification of destruction? And we both said, wow,
that's a big idea.
And the only example he had at that time was the Exocet weapon, which had been used in the Falklands or Malvinas War. And he said, that's customized, one target, one weapon. And
he said, as in Vietnam and in the past, you destroy an entire village to get one building, or an entire part of a city to target one building. But this will no longer be necessary in the future. So that got us to thinking. But we still, and we said, well, why did you read our book? Because there's nothing about the military in it. He said, because what happens, you describe what's going to happen in society, and what happens in society happens to us as well. It turned out we met him. He's a remarkable guy. He died shortly thereafter. Indeed, as we left our first evening together, as we had finished a very sparkling intellectual conversation, he turned to us and he said, I'm 49 years old and I'm dying, and it will be the fulfillment of my life if this new doctrine is adopted. And indeed, he did die of cancer not long thereafter.
Right after that, he invited us to TRADOC, which is the Training and Army Doctrine Command. And we talked with General Story, and he explained the changes they were making in the Army with the training of soldiers.
He basically said, we have a second wave army, and we need a third wave army. And this is where we have to go. Now, the amazing thing about that was all in 1981.
But one of the briefing that General Morelli gave us was called Air-Land Battle, and Air-Land Battle 2000. The next time we heard that term was watching the Gulf War on CNN, when they used Air-Land Battle, and we said, here it is. And we really need to write about this because we understand what's happening, and most people don't.
It's a profound...
It's not just high-tech weapons.
It's a profound social transformation. War is such a central phenomenon to social development throughout history that not to understand war and its relationship to the society, and not to understand that it is social, cultural, economic, as well as just technological, and not to understand the directions in which it's moving, is to not understand your own society. And so even after meeting with these highly intelligent military intellectuals, we never intended to write about it. But Morelli had taken us up to his hotel room and shown us a briefing slide.
Which he'd shown to Bush, who was vice president that morning.
Yeah. And we'd never forgotten that. Never wrote a word about it. And then the night Baghdad was bombed and CNN had those astonishing pictures, we were blown away, so to speak, because we had essentially seen that in his hotel room 10 or 12 years before. We were struck by what we were seeing on camera was the implementation of the doctrine that he and Starry and a group of others had written over a decade
ago.
But
during the Gulf conflict, we saw two different forms of warfare. We saw the carpet bombing of the Republican forces in the bunkers, which we call traditional second wave mass destruction.
Yes.
And then we saw also the precision.
That's the beginning of third wave
bombs.
Warfare.
The bombs actually had the cameras mounted on them,
yes.
So you could watch them do their one-on-one.
Right, basically, Saddam Hussein fought a traditional second wave war. Used a traditional second wave war form is the term we use, which he had actually gotten from the Russians and developed and so on. We attacked him using two different war forms. One was second wave war form in the south, and the other was a third wave war form in Baghdad, and he did not know what hit him. And the essence of the third wave war form is to take out the opposition's information capability. You strike at the communications, you strike at the brain, you strike at the nervous system, you strike at anything that permits the opponent to know what's going on, even. And in fact, what won this war was not air superiority, which is what the Air Force likes to claim. What won this war was information superiority. And that is what's going to win competitive battles in business, and that is what's going to win social problems and social battles politically as well.
My guests today are Alvin and Heidi Toffler. They're social thinkers and futurists. Alvin Toffler is often remembered as the author of the popular 1970 book Future Shock. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Alvin, you're listed as the author of Future Shock, but I understand, Heidi, that you co-authored it as well. Why wasn't your name on the book?
It's a hard question to answer. For a variety of reasons, I wanted the credit, but in the acknowledgments, and I thought that my name should not be on the jacket, on the cover. I felt the same way about the third wave and Power Shift. I weakened. And
the next book, his name will be off.
Well, no, I don't think so. But in the introduction to Power Shift, Al very clearly states that we are both the authors of the book. And it was what happened after that that made me decide to put my name on the cover of this book. It wasn't my feminist friends who accused me of being a poor role model for other women that got to me. It was the men who came up to me, and there were at least 100 of them, who meant well, but who came up to me and said, Heidi, we just want to tell you what a wonderful husband we think you have. He gives you so much credit. And in parentheses after that was, of course, which you don't deserve. So that decided me. If the 101st man came up to me, I think I would have, made a fist and possibly not been so polite. But that was what tipped them.
I must say, I was talking to someone yesterday, and I said, oh, yes, war and anti-war, Alvin and Heidi Toffler. And this person said, oh, new young wife. She's jumping on the bandwagon.
43 years.
But we have, we've been working together for 45 years at college. Al, when I met him, was putting out a literary magazine, and I very soon got drafted to work on that, writing, you know, all kinds of book reviews and movie reviews. And throughout the years, except for when our daughter was born, and when we both worked separately in factories for 4 or 5 years, we basically have worked together.
We spoke recently with Edward Teller, and he told us that he believed Americans in general don't believe in the inevitability of war because there's never been any international wars fought here, and he thought the rest of the world did. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I think we are complacent. We are lucky for all our history. The oceans protected us. The only significant war was our own Civil War, which was a monumental horror. But in fact, most Americans are completely unaware of what's going on in the world today. On average, in every year from 1945 to last year, the average number of violent conflicts on the planet were somewhere in the range of 30 to 35. This year, there are 62. And the problem is this. Yes, a lot of them don't really involve us. America is not clear about its vital interests. Why are we here and not there, and so on. It's unclear. I think our administration is completely foggy about this at present. But some of the conflicts looming, the next Bosnia could very well be a Bosnia somewhere else with nukes. The next use of chemical weapons against a helpless population may not come from Iraq, but from a neighbor of Iraq against the Kurds. The North Korean nuclear question terrifies the Japanese. It means that Japan is probably going to become a nuclear-armed nation. The Pacific is the most important engine of the global economy, and the United States economy would probably collapse without the Pacific economy. The only thing that could disrupt that is military instabilities in that region, and that's what's beginning to bubble up over there. So there are not only many points of conflict and violence, but many of them affect us directly and affect the jobs. We talk about jobs and NAFTA and so on. Many American jobs are totally dependent on this, on relative stability in the global economy.
Yeah, but question is, will they be fought on American soil?
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think we have been lulled by the last 50 years or longer. But that, I think, was a result of the mutually assured destruction of the nuclear weapons. And I think that when we saw the rejoicing that took place when the Berlin Wall fell, and it was fairly clear to the American population that that threat was over with, I think all of the rejoicing and the anticipation of a huge peace dividend, and this symbolizing, in a sense, the end of war, was an expression of that feeling that Teller talks about. And I think we were dead wrong. I think that the chance of war is much greater today. War that involves the United States and possibly even, if you want to consider terrorism, war of a kind.
And
we're beginning to see that in the trade towers, in all kinds of manifestations.
Okay, and the next step...
And we probably will see more.
The next step is not a group of klutzy terrorists putting a big fat bomb in a building.
Materials.
The next step is information terrorism. It means the oceans no longer protect us. We are the most, of all the countries in the world, we are the most dependent upon our electronic infrastructure, our information technology, our computers, our wireless systems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We are totally dependent upon that. Your job, everybody's jobs, are now dependent upon this infrastructure. That infrastructure was not built with the idea of security. Most businesses don't even have sufficient backups for their systems. So that opens the possibility of terrorists sitting 10,000 miles away, maybe 18-year-old fanatic Muslims or some other creed, punching away at a laptop and intervening in our electronic infrastructure through networks that now connect us all over the world. It, in fact, so vulnerable is our system that we know one former senior intelligence official who claims that with $1 million and 20 men or women, he can shut America down, shut the Federal Reserve Bank, shut the ATMs around the country, shut down the computers that are all synchronized in a certain way in this country. He can block our the ability to move our troops offshore, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that he believes, and this is a highly intelligent guy, that we are exceedingly vulnerable. Paul Strassman, who used to be the chief information officer of Xerox, or the head information scientist at Xerox before many years ago, talks about info-terrorism as the next wave. So we're not just going to see a couple of bearded people skulking around in a truck in the basement of the World Trade Towers. What we're going to see are invisible knowledge attacks or attacks on our knowledge system. And this is why America needs a knowledge strategy. It needs a knowledge strategy for economic purposes to compete in the world. We are not going to put all those people back on assembly lines and smokestack factories using their muscles to produce. We're going to be using our brains to produce more and more. Here we can sum it up in one phrase. Both economically and militarily, we are moving from brute force to brain force.
Heidi, Alvin, thank you so much for joining us.
Our pleasure.
Yes, thank you.
My guests today have been Alvin and Heidi Toffler. They are authors of the book War and Anti-War, Survival at the Dawn of the 21st Century, published by Little Brown. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Knowing that many of the new weapons, as well as information systems, require satellites or vehicles in space, it made me wonder, who's in charge of space? Lieutenant General Thomas Moorman is Vice Commander of the Air Force Space Command. I asked him to tell us about the U.S. Space Command and its relation to the Air Force Space Command.
Well, that's a good start-off question because the military does have quite an infrastructure in space. In Colorado Springs, we have a unified space command. And for your listeners, that is a unified command is a joint command with Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Air Force participation. Four-star general, General Chuck Horner, runs that, who was the air chief during the Desert War. Underneath that, he has three space commands, an Army Space Command, a Naval Space Command, Army being in Colorado Springs, Naval being in Dahlgren, Virginia on the Chesapeake, and then Air Force Space Command that I represent. It is overwhelmingly the largest because the Air Force is the biggest actor in space. And in our command, what we do is basically five things. We do surveil space with optical and radar systems to see what's up there, and we track about 7,200 objects. We worry the space debris problem. We operate missile warning sites and satellites, the ballistic missile early warning system, for example, and the DSP warning satellite that was used in the war. We do satellite command and control for all the DoD satellites and some NATO satellites. That is, we keep track of health and status. The last space mission is we operate the two military launch sites, one in Florida at Cape Canaveral, and the other one right here in California, Vandenberg Air Force Base near Lompoc in Santa Barbara County. And the newest mission is we picked up the responsibility to operate the Intercontinental Ballistic Missile mission, the strategic missiles. And so we have basically five missions.
How long has the U.S. Space Command been in existence?
1985, relatively new phenomena. Air Force Space Command was created in 82, Navy in 83, unified in 85, and army in 88. So you could say that the 80s were the organizational decade for space and the armed services.
Under the mission of space control, I noticed the mission of denying the adversary. I love that phrase, denying the adversary. What does that mean?
Several components to that. The first thing you think of is the operation of an anti-satellite system. The country does not have an anti-satellite system. It has been a political issue, as you may know and your listeners may know, for several decades, really. We've had several development programs. We had an F-15 that had a missile slung underneath it that would fly up, and we actually tested and shot a satellite down in 85. That got canceled. The Army then picked up the mission to have a ground-based rocket with a kinetic energy kill device. It also got canceled. So the armed services don't have an active anti-satellite program. Now, having said that, there's other components to it. The space surveillance network that I mentioned to you, this worldwide optical and radar systems, is a component of space control in that you want to know what's going on there and what's up there and what's going on up there. And so we do that every day for the United Nations, as a matter of fact. We are the most comprehensive space surveillance system. Then any survivability measures that you put on satellites, a hardening of a satellite, a maneuver capability, those kinds of things also come into that space control mission area. I happen to believe at some juncture we will probably have to have an anti-satellite system as space proliferates worldwide and people can target us from space. So.
How does NASA relate to the Space Command?
Some direct relationships and then some indirect relationships. For example, the Air Force astronauts at Johnson administratively come under Air Force Space Command. We worry about their careers and their records and whatever have you, and follow-on assignments. That's about a four-year phenomenon. It used to belong to the Pentagon, now it belongs to Space Command. Then we also provide, when you have a shuttle launch, for example, we provide the safety services as well as the range services to keep track of the shuttle as it launches. And then right here at Onizuka in Sunnyvale, Onizuka Air Force Station, we back up Johnson for satellite command and control or shuttle command and control. Now, that's the tangible what we do. We have a bunch of other relationships as we look to the future. That is, we are working together to define where the country should go as a future launch system, for example. And we have several committees. And so I think the relationship, frankly, between NASA and the Air Force or the civil space sector and the national security space sector are inevitably going to be a lot closer.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Lieutenant General Thomas Moorman, currently the Vice Commander of the Air Force Space Command. He has served as Director of Space Systems within the Office of the Secretary of the Air Force. What role did the Air Force Space Command play in Desert Storm?
The thing I would like your listeners to get out of my answer here, and I'm going to give you the bottom line to start with, is that Desert Storm was an absolute watershed event for space. My chief, General McPeak, has described it as the first space war. Not that we, Star Wars, that we fought in space, but rather it was the first time that space had played a critical role in the outcome of conflict. To be sure, we'd use space back to Vietnam, but never in a comprehensive way. In Desert Storm, we used weather satellites to determine civil weather systems fly at geosynchronous altitudes and give you hemispheric weather pictures, what you're used to seeing in your evening news. We fly a low-altitude system in the military, which can allow you to do micrometeorology. That is, you can tell the weather specifically different in the different states of weather, perhaps, in just a city, for example. What that means militarily is in Desert Storm, we used weather, direct feeds of weather, to determine whether or not to load a dumb bomb if it is bad weather and the target's obscured, or a smart bomb if you can see it and laser designate it and drive the bomb into the target. Our weather satellite also carries a microwave imager. The technology is not that important. What's significant about it is it allows you, for example, to determine the moisture content of the soil. That was used in Desert Storm such that we had terrible weather over there, worst weather in 14 years during Desert Storm in the Arabian Peninsula. This allowed us to tell General Schwarzkopf where there was wet soil and mud so he could plan his invasion routes so his armor wouldn't get stuck, a very close feedback. So that's weather. Warning, most of us sat transfixed during the war watching the Scud warning and the capabilities of the Patriot. The warning of those launches was provided from space, from an infrared satellite that picked up the plume of the launch of the Scud. We processed the data, got it back into the theater within 2 or 3 minutes, such that we could warn the populace to take cover, or you could warn the coalition forces to don the gas mask and whatnot. And then finally, we gave timing information to the Patriot batteries through space, as well as a rough azimuth of what direction the attack would be coming from. So that's weather and warning. Navigation. This country flies a navigational satellite called the Global Positioning System. There are now some 25 satellites up now. It gives you a positional accuracy of less than 50 feet anywhere in the world, any time of day, as long as you have a receiver, which incidentally most of the receivers are made here in California. That was perfect in Desert Storm because what you had over there were miles and miles of sand dunes, featureless terrain, no good landmarks to navigate by, and generally poor maps. And so we produced a tremendous number of receivers, and they were used by all services to pinpoint where you were. Tremendous force multiplication capability, and I believe that particular satellite will revolutionize a lot of the way we do weapons employment. Lastly, I guess, is communications. This war was a satellite communications war as opposed to landlines. 90% of all the communications back to the United States, for example, were satellite-borne. But more significantly, about 60% intra-theater, were satellite-borne. We had a tremendous number of receivers and antennas up there picking up satellite communications. Now, the long and the short of it is that because the promise of space was realized in Desert Storm, the Air Force, for example, changed their mission statement. We had traditionally been focused towards strictly air. When you think of the Air Force, you think of airplanes. As a result of Desert Storm and the growing importance of space, the Air Force mission now is to defend the United States through the control and exploitation of air and space. Space is now a co-equal partner with air in the United States Air Force.
The satellites were tracking the Scuds as they were launched were clearly over Iraq. They would obviously be taking an image, and someone or something has to observe that image and then communicate that. Was that all located in Iraq?
No. The data would come back to a ground station, be processed either overseas or in the United States, they would pick it up in the speed of light, then it would come to Colorado Springs to evaluate the validity, and then back into Iraq, all within 2 to 3 minutes.
So that the information was synthesized, transmitted, synthesized, and then verified by a human.
Yes.
Back in Colorado Springs.
Yeah.
And then once they said, yep, this is it.
Well, I'm misleading you a bit, Mara, in that it was also looked at by a human at the ground station.
Ah.
But it was processed or looked at and evaluated in Colorado Springs as well.
Then, so two humans, one at a ground station, one at Colorado Springs, and then back there to say, hey, this is real.
This is a real attack.
All within 2 to 3 minutes.
Yeah.
One place I'm fascinated by is Cheyenne Mountain. Tell us about Cheyenne Mountain.
Cheyenne Mountain is a command center wherein we do the strategic defense mission for the country. Cheyenne Mountain is a granite mountain there where we have 1,200 people who work inside this mountain. It was built in the early 60s in the height of the Cold War, and the idea was to be survivable against any kinds of attack. It's not as survivable as it once was, but of course the threat is not nearly as great. But in the mountain, we basically worry about missile defense, air defense, and space defense, if you will. It's the nerve center. The mountain supports two commands, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, which is a binational command with the Canadians, NORAD, as many people know it, and if we were to operate unilaterally, U.S. Space Command, which I mentioned earlier was this joint space activity. But space, missiles, and air defense. And it would be a center if we were to have a ballistic missile defense of the United States. It would probably be commanded and controlled out of Cheyenne Mountain.
And Cheyenne Mountain is located in Colorado.
In Colorado Springs, excuse me. Yeah, it's on the southern part of town in Colorado Springs. So.
I know that part of your mission under space surveillance is determining which country owns a re-entering space object. What are the rules? How do you figure it out?
Well, that begins with seeing every launch, back to the comment about satellites, warning satellites. Well, we see every launch and know from whence they came. Then we turn it over to the Space Surveillance Network that looks at it and catalogs it and figures out what the orbit is and where it is at all times. And we constantly observe it. We do 20 or 30,000 observations a day through this worldwide network. Then if it's a low-altitude system, after a while it begins to degrade. There is drag in space. And if it's going to re-enter, then we start doing calculations as to when and where is it going to re-enter. But all the time we have cataloged it, put a number next to it, and we know who owns the piece of, whether it be a satellite or a piece of debris. And that's something that we keep track of.
So if one of our satellites lands in Nova Scotia, is that considered our property or Nova Scotia's property?
Good point. It is our satellite. Nova Scotians probably don't want it that much because by the time it re-enters, it is just a blob of blaze and metal. But the significant thing, why it's so important, is by treaty, if there is any damage as a result of reentering, the host country, that is the country that launched it, is responsible. Most prominent case that your listeners may remember is in the early 80s, the Russians had a reentering satellite with a nuclear power plant. And Cosmos 954, it came in over Canada. And the Russians paid the Canadians to clean it up.
I understand that the Air Force is now undertaking a study to envision space capabilities, applications, and systems that would be required for the national security in the far future. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, this is a study called Space Gas 2020. That is, what should space look like and what should be the Air Force's role in space in the year 2020. We are doing that at Maxwell Air Force Base, which is our center of professional military education. A bunch of students, about 150 of them, are doing this. I was just there yesterday, so it's a topical question. And they began with a data call to try to figure out what the state of nature would be in 2020. And they had a lot of futurists come talk to them. Alvin Toffler came to talk to them. Carl Sagan came to talk to them. Lots of people who write books about what the world would look like then. They are taking that data, developing a database, and then seeing how it applies to space. Now, one of the clear things is that space will be much more important, that it may be an arena for warfare. It may also be a significant arena to keep the peace. It's kind of an interesting dichotomy there. But it will clearly be more important. In that it takes you such a long time to develop space capabilities and they're so expensive, this study is key to our understanding of how we want to position ourselves, particularly what technologies do we want to develop. One thing for sure, what I mentioned earlier, is that the processing of information and fusing of information is going to be key in future conflict. And space is particularly well suited for that. It's an enabler. It's the front end of all that. And we will posture organizationally as well as technologically in the Air Force based upon this study.
My guest today is General Thomas Moorman. He is the Vice Commander of the Air Force Space Command, and in 1991 he received the Thomas D. White United States Air Force Space Trophy presented by the National Geographic Society. This award is given to the individual who has made the most outstanding contribution to our nation's progress in space. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Can the use of space technology save lives?
Yeah, I want to make a point of that because, yes, the answer is indeed so. Let me give you some examples of the way of thinking about that. We are now working a demonstration for employing a navigational receiver wherein the accuracy that you get from space in navigation is put into a rescue radio, such that downed pilots, either during war or normally, instead of just transmitting out a signal of where they are, which makes them vulnerable to be picked up by the enemy, it's not a very precise signal. We now, by putting a navigation receiver in there, you know exactly where the person is so you can go pick them up. And as I say, that has peacetime as well as wartime applications. Another thought about saving lives is that in the future, I see us using many more standoff weapons. In Desert Storm, for example, you saw people fly to downtown Baghdad and go into harm's way and become vulnerable. Fortunately, we didn't lose many. But I see us, again, using that navigational satellite, giving data to a missile en route, so that you can get these extreme accuracies. The satellite, if you will, flies the weapon, the missile, such that the pilot never has to get into harm's way. Another aspect is, I mentioned earlier, the space to the shooter, getting intelligence data directly into the cockpit. And imagine an airplane that has a mission of killing radars for surface-to-air missiles. He has to emanate. The missile site has to have a radar that is on all the time to pick you up. Well, getting intelligence data down to an airplane, processing it, knowing where that site is, putting it into an anti-radiation missile, and then firing the missile based upon what space told you. My vision is the airplane that is carrying that missile never has to get within the lethal envelope, because he can now use space, and so he's much less vulnerable than our conventional way of doing business. So All in all, you know, Desert Storm, I think, showed us an American way of war, if you will, and that is, let's have clearer aims, let's use substantial force to achieve those aims, let's have the least amount of lives lost, not only ours, but our enemies as well, and civilian casualties. Space allows a lot of precision to modern warfare, and that's why I continue to emphasize, I think it'll be more and more important.
We want to take out the bunker, not the people.
Exactly.
You flew in this morning from Colorado Springs. Did you take a commercial flight?
No, I came in a C-21, which is an executive jet, which is a fine airplane. It allows me to I will fly back to Colorado Springs tonight, so it allows me to travel quickly.
Well, I must say, yesterday when I was speaking with Colonel Gauci yesterday, and he was saying, well, the general will be flying in the morning, and I went, oh, my goodness, you know, he's going to be late. You know, don't know what's going to happen with the airplanes, the way they're running. I'm like, but if any guy can get here, General Mormon can get here. Now, the president flies Air Force One, and the vice president Air Force Two. What number is your plane?
Air Force X, I don't know. The Air Force operates, I think, six or seven different nodes where they have these executive jets, and they are used primarily for training, but we get the benefit of being able to use them for travel as well.
I looked over your resume, and I didn't seem to say you were a pilot. Are you a pilot?
No, I am not. I am a space person.
Well, isn't that unusual to be a general in the Air Force and not be a pilot?
Years ago it was, in the early 60s. In fact, I'm fourth generation military. My father is a pilot and was a senior officer in the Air Force as well. But I think it is a manifestation of the change of the Air Force in that we now have, I don't know what the percentage is, but we have a lot of non-pilot generals now, a significant number. And I think it's just a reflection of that little bit of a change in emphasis, that the opportunities are greater, higher technology, et cetera, such that if there are tremendous careers for non-pilots in the United States Air Force.
And General Horner is head of both the U.S. Space Command and the Air Force Space Command. And I understand that normally either you or he must physically be at the Space Command, but that neither one of you are there right now, that you had to get a special permission to leave. Who did you have to ask?
I had to ask the Vice Chief of Staff of the Air Force. It's called a dual absence, and the reason he approved it is this evening I'll be talking to the Commonwealth Club, and that's just a wonderful public forum to talk about our missions. And so, but one of the reasons I have that airplane is so I come right back right after I finish speaking tonight. So,
well, see, what I really want to point out is that I go home and I have these two boys, and they say, well, you can't boss me around. I'm in charge. And I go, hey, I talked to General Mormon. And even he had to ask to leave. So this is really big. Now, here's the big final question. And maybe the toughest question of all. Do you have the Dakota ring?
Got it right here.
Oh.
What do you want me to decode?
I wanted to know. General Mormon, thank you so much for joining us. My guest today has been General Thomas Mormon. He is the Vice Commander of the Air Force Space Command. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco Songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.